Good evening and welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Paris Schutz. We'll be joined by our Week in Review guests in just a moment. But first, some of today's top stories. A Chicago police officer is in the hospital in serious but stable condition this evening after being shot multiple times responding to a domestic disturbance. Police Superintendent David Brown says it happened on West Taylor Street this morning in Little Italy when the suspect opened fire on officers immediately as they arrived on the scene. Brown says a suspect is in custody and a gun has been recovered.
And we ask that you all continue to pray for this officer's full recovery and for the officer's family, as well as the men and women of the Chicago Police Department and their families, to continue to do all they can to protect the people of Chicago. Due to these brave and courageous efforts of not only the officer that was wounded this morning, but to all the officers every day giving everything to protect the people of Chicago.
Meanwhile, Mayor Lori Lightfoot and city public safety leaders discussed their safety plan for the 4th of July weekend. The mayor says there will be enhanced public safety in and around Navy Pier for the fireworks show. City also released its June homicide numbers, showing a drop in murders over June of last year. And to date, murders are down 10% over where they were at this point last year.
Our whole of city muscle has been flexed and is working, resulting in a steady decrease in shootings and murders throughout the past few months.
Chicago Bulls star Zach LaVine is coming back for the long term, and he's getting a major, actually a record payday. LaVine and the Bulls agreed to a five-year, $215 million contract, which makes it the largest contract in team history. LaVine averaged 24.4 points a game last year as the Bulls made it to the playoffs for the first time in five seasons, but he is recovering from off-season knee surgery. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Craig Delamore, longtime political editor for WBBM News Radio, our own Amanda Vinicky, Jeremy Gorn, who covers State House politics for the Chicago Tribune, and Dan Mihalopoulos, investigative reporter on WBEZ's government and politics team. Let's dig right into it. In Darren Bailey's victory speech last night, he pitched himself as an everyman farmer up against an out-of-touch billionaire and even seemed to be courting Chicago voters.
Let's hear it up for Chicago tonight. We got anybody here? Uh-huh. Right there's how it's going in Chicago. God bless you. Wow. Friends, billionaires like Pritzker can't relate to the struggles of working people and taxpayers like us. It's that simple. You and I have to balance our family budgets. Billionaire Pritzker has never had to.
Let's hear it for Chicago. Quite a bit different than saying Chicago is a hellhole. Craig Delamore, would you anticipate the traditional tack to the center here in this campaign, or is Darren Bailey just going to continue on with his conservative bona fides?
I think Darren Bailey is going to try to keep to the right, because frankly, that's not only his base. Remember, his victory was not just downstate. He ran strong among Republicans up in the northern part of Illinois, too. So clearly the message is working. Clearly still embracing Donald Trump is working. But you can see he softened a bit on Chicago. So, you know, there'll be a little bit of tweaking. But I think we're going to see the Darren Bailey that's the folksy farmer, but also underneath the studious and very crafty politician.
Wonder if he's moderated his feelings on Chicago seceding from the rest of the state of Illinois. Dan Mihalopoulos, Bailey did beg for Trump's endorsement. He finally got it really late in the game. Do you think he hangs on to Trump, or is he going to try and run away from Trump over the next few months?
Oh, no. I mean, he was up by 17 points in the poll that we in the Sun-Times had before Donald Trump endorsed him. And so he probably did not need Donald Trump's endorsement, but authentically he wants it. And this is Darren Bailey. You know, I think he is going to try to hit J.B. Pritzker, but at the same time, he wanted the embrace of another billionaire in Donald Trump. We also don't know really that Darren Bailey is this folksy farmer in the sense that, you know, he's got a farm that's the size of Schaumburg. Okay, he's gotten millions of dollars in federal taxpayer subsidies, farm subsidies, at the same time that he has espoused free market economics as his political stand. So does he really have to balance his budget like you and I do, Paris? We don't know. He doesn't want to release his tax returns. And in this sense, again, he is mimicking his idol, Donald Trump.
Well, that was my next question to Amanda Vinicky. He says he doesn't want to release his income tax returns. Is that why? Because it might show voters how much he is getting from the federal government for his big farm?
I mean, I think we can know pretty well what he's getting from the federal government because we can look that up. We've been aware that he's getting that money. What he might not want disclosed is just his personal assets, how big that agribusiness is, how wealthy he is, or perhaps if it isn't going so well, nothing that we have seen of that, but maybe that's what it looked good if you're trying to run as the guy who can balance a budget. We don't know until we can have a look at them in even those top files. So it is something that I think he was able to get by the primary. Without that, some of the candidates in the primary did release their tax returns. Bailey didn't. He wasn't punished for it by voters this time around. And I think the expectation is by the calculus, one would assume by his campaign, I haven't had the opportunity to interview him personally about any of this, is that Pritzker is a billionaire. Who cares what his tax returns say?
All right. Well, Pritzker wasted no time in going after Bailey at his victory rally. Take a look.
Let me be clear. Someone who seeks out and accepts the endorsement of a racist, misogynistic, homophobic, xenophobic, twice impeached former president does not deserve to come anywhere near this state's highest office.
Harsh words there, Jeremy Gorner, but let us be clear here. This is the matchup that J.B. Pritzker wanted. Any chance that he might regret helping bankroll forces that helped get Bailey that nomination?
I don't think so, Paris. I mean, let's look at the Trump endorsement, for example. President Trump didn't do too well in Illinois when he ran for president here. And I think a lot of Republican voters, you know, if they haven't been following the primary that closely and there was low voter turnout, they might look at if there's anything they know about Darren Bailey. If they don't know anything else, they know that he got endorsed by Donald Trump. And there's a reason that J.B. Pritzker is banking on that, because he knows what Republicans are going to think nowadays. Richard Irvin, who billionaire Ken Griffin spent $50 million on, it appeared early on, Irvin was the favorite just because of the money he had alone. Irvin finished third in the primary. One of his big talking points towards the end, leading to June 28th, was that in order for a Republican to beat J.B. Pritzker, you need, you really need a lot of Democrats to kind of cross over. You need independents to kind of be won over by a Republican candidate. Bailey, as what we've seen so far, hasn't really shown that he's willing to compromise like that. I mean, like Craig was saying, perhaps he's been a little nicer the last few days, you know, kind of backing away from calling Chicago a hellhole, but it's going to take a long time. If he's going to win the election, he's got to win over independents and Democrats, and that's going to be hard to do against Pritzker in November.
Right. That's going to take a heck of a lot of strategizing. Speaking of Richard Irvin, Craig Delamore, he got $50+ million from Ken Griffin. He finished third. What went wrong with this campaign?
I think some of it, remember, politics is supposed to be about addition, not subtraction. I think one of the problems was that Richard Irvin had a great story, his background from a modest, even poor beginnings, public housing, in the service. All of that made him almost the perfect candidate to go up against J.B. Pritzker in the general. But the problem is you got to get through the Republican primary, and that's a totally different battlefield. First, he had to answer to those who were questioning whether he was going to be Ken Griffin's puppet. He got probably past that, but then the question was, is he really a Republican? Because frankly, he is not the ultra-conservative that he was trying to, that his messages were saying he was. He really is a moderate, and then, what did he do in the last election? Did he vote for Trump? And he wouldn't answer. And I think that winnowed more people away from him. And I think that was the problem going along, was that he kept losing small pockets of support till Bailey came in and wrapped them all up.
And certainly there were a lot of ads funded by interests close to Darren Bailey and interests close to Pritzker that brought up a lot of problems with the Irvin campaign. Dan Milopoulos, it almost felt like this campaign had a narrative before they had a candidate, because the candidate had positions in the past that were directly at odds with the positions he was espousing in this campaign. We had discovered in our investigations a pay-to-play style of governance in Aurora, troubling pattern there. Did this team that ran this campaign, they ran Rauner's campaigns, they're from the Mark Kirk wing of the party, did they not vet this candidate properly, or did they just think that the narrative would win the day?
I think they would argue that they came across a very difficult situation with not only the tens of millions of dollars, we don't even have the final accounting yet, that came from J.B. Pritzker and the Democratic Governors Association attacking Ervin so that they would get Bailey in the general election against J.B. Pritzker instead of Ervin. I think, you know, you just have a situation here, as Craig said before, where you have to go very far to the right to win a nomination now. And, you know, Ervin's in a position where he doesn't want to go that far right because he's looking toward the general election, who he is authentically. That's also a good question. But, you know, a couple issues that came to the fore during this campaign that made this sort of shift from the right to the center particularly difficult. One, abortion taking center stage. How do you address this issue? You know, most of the state is in favor of abortion rights, but a lot of your primary voters on the Republican side are not, and this issue got crystallized in a very dramatic way. He tried to dodge that issue, Richard Ervin, and his campaign tried to dance around it. They also tried to dance around the issue of Trump, which was crystallized once again when you at WTTW reported on those text messages that ended up in your hands somehow, in which he was criticizing Donald Trump, you know, even calling him a racist, I believe, if I recall correctly. Well, again, he's in a primary at that point where he's trying to dance around questions about Trump, but at times in the past, he made it clear when he was merely the mayor of Aurora and not seeking the Republican nomination for governor, at those times, he was critical of Trump.
Right, right. When he wasn't under the heat of this campaign. Amanda, Ken Griffin left the state of Illinois or announced he's leaving, taking his company with him to Florida before this election even happened. Is this the last we hear from him in Illinois politics?
I imagine so, and I think that's another thing that dogged the Ervin campaign. You could clearly see that the checks stopped coming. That was never announced, but it certainly became obvious when the Ervin campaign was no longer to maintain its presence in commercials and ads in the southern state, in the southern part of the state. And so I think that also changed the trajectory, because we had heard Ken Griffin say he's all in, and then whatever happened, it appeared, in fact, no, he was not all in. He was only $50 million in, and not as much as it would take. And so I don't think that this is going to be easy for any of the Republicans statewide, whether they were on Ervin's ticket or on the Ervin Ken Griffin ticket or otherwise, just because Democrats have J.B. Pritzker's own billions to run on, as well as labor that has a lot of people and a lot of money. And so this makes it very difficult for Republicans to go toe-to-toe. You do have Darren Bailey with associations with Richard Uihlein, who, so you got some money coming in to at least his campaign, but is Uihlein going to be right, giving any to Demmer, to Brady, and some of these other constitutional offices?
Uihlein spent about $9 million in the primary here for Bailey. We'll see if he spends any in the general election. Jeremy Gorner, is the victory here of Darren Bailey mean that basically it's his Illinois Republican Party? Because if we look at the history of the Republican Party here, it's a more moderate party, especially on the social issues, dominated by some of the suburban representatives. Does this signal that those days are over and the party is a Trump-style party like it is across the nation?
I mean, on paper, it looks like, you know, that would be kind of the long-term investment on, you know, even if he doesn't win the election, that could, you know, inspire some change on the Republican side in Illinois. I mean, we're seeing this across the country where in other states and even national offices where more moderate wings of the Republican Party have gone even further to the right. And I think that the Bailey, so like here's an example, the Bailey win is emblematic of Congresswoman Mary Miller, an incumbent defeating another incumbent, Rodney Davis, downstate after the redistricting. Now, Rodney Davis, this is, you know, this could have national, this is probably a good national example. He was very highly regarded among the Republicans in Congress, kind of, you know, sort of moderate, but he was a Trump supporter. He likes to tout that. Mary Miller had, he had been around for 10 years in Congress. Mary Miller had only been around for 2 years in Congress before defeating Rodney Davis on Tuesday. And she had the Trump endorsement. And that really made a world of difference for her. I was at the Trump rally last weekend, and I remember and talking to some Trump supporters, one of whom I asked about Mary Miller, what is it about Mary Miller that she like over Rodney Davis? And this person said, well, I can't really get specific other than the fact that Donald Trump is endorsing her, and that's enough for me. And Donald Trump that day also endorsed Darren Bailey. That could be enough for a lot of Republicans in this state alone. That goes, you know, a long way. So even if he doesn't win this election, that could very well signal a long-term sea change that we could see slowly but surely, you know, in the Republican Party in Illinois, regardless of whether Bailey wins in November.
So that Trump endorsement, the Midas touch in the primary, but might be the kiss of death, at least for Bailey, in the general election. Craig Delamore, let's talk about some of these other congressional results. We have winners like Sean Casten in the 6th District, Delia Ramirez in the newly drawn 3rd District, which is heavily Latino. Danny Davis wins again after a tough challenge in the 7th there. And then Jonathan Jackson, the son of civil rights icon Jesse Jackson, in the 1st after Bobby Rush is stepping down after this term. Do these results say anything consistent about the direction of the Democratic Party?
I think the congressional races say a little bit more about the districts that they're representing rather than some kind of national trend, although more progressive would be the one thing you could say, because Delia Ramirez, you get two progressive candidates. Gilbert Villegas, the Chicago alderman, was essentially progressive, but Delia Ramirez, considerably more progressive, and got AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez backing her, and Bernie Sanders, that kind of thing, won the day there. Jonathan Jackson won with a lot of help from the crypto business. So I'm not sure what that says yet, but he is Jesse Jackson's son. He is well-spoken. He's a businessman. He also had a ridiculously crowded field, 17 yeah. Democrats, and at least three or four other candidates who are respected and well-known, probably split the vote among them, at least the women did, and Jackson squeaks through. I think Danny Davis squeaked through his race. Keena Collins, thank you. Blanked on her last name. But Keena Collins did very well. It's a rematch for her, and she got even closer this time. So I think the messages are all over, but it has to do with the individuals and where they're running.
Yeah, it does seem like the person that won in these districts kind of maybe fit the tenor of those districts specifically. Craig mentioned Dan Mihalopoulos, this crypto help that Jonathan Jackson got. It was reported that he'd gotten $500 million in support from a cryptocurrency billionaire. What is the nature of that support, and why is the name of the billionaire escapes me now, but what is his interest in this candidacy?
We don't really know at this point. They're dropping money in different parts of the country. What committees would this congressman be on? It's all very, very new to a lot of us. I mean, I think Lynn Sweet in the Sun-Times broke the story of that contribution not too long before the primary, just in the last couple weeks. So your guess is as good as mine what they the regulatory issues will be with them in Congress, but definitely put Jonathan Jackson over the top in a very crowded field. I think he got a little bit more than I thought the winner in the race would get, because it was really, really split up, but nobody really emerged. Bobby Rush endorsed somebody else almost as soon as he said he would retire. So it made a huge difference. And Jonathan Jackson now is taking up the mantle. I think that's really been the case in the Jackson family since Jesse Jr., who was a congressman himself, was indicted and jailed for corruption. He and his wife, his alderman wife, both. So the Jackson name continues, and the Jackson name is almost certain to be in the rolls of the U.S. House of Representatives early next year.
Jonathan Jackson certainly hoping that his career doesn't go the way that his brothers did, Jesse Jr., you mentioned, with those that corruption scandal. Let's move on to some of the shocking testimony we heard in the January 6th hearings this week. Former assistant to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson, testified that President Trump knew his supporters were armed ahead of the violent attack on the Capitol.
I was part of a conversation. I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
And, of course, the other bombshell was her revelation that Trump allegedly reached over the seat to try and take the wheel of his presidential motorcade car, the SUV, and that he assaulted another security Secret Service agent. Then there was some whispers that that wasn't true, and now it seems to be a little more corroborated today. Amanda Vinicky, does anything that we heard increase the odds here of a possible criminal indictment against the president, or at least some of his alleged co-conspirators like Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani?
I'm no lawyer, but yes, it would. That would seem to elevate this. I mean, if you've been listening to the hearings, there is a lot of damning testimony and evidence that would lead one to think that that is the track. We haven't really heard much from the Department of Justice, pointedly, because they're not supposed to be getting involved in politics and tipping their hand at all on any of these things. But certainly, I think it raises this pressure on the DOJ to eventually take some actions, because you watch that and kind of say, okay, this has to be something, right? And by the way, this isn't the last of it. More hearings are still to come, although we'll have to be waiting for them. So yes, I think you watch those, and yes, it changes minds for those who are, I think, I don't know how much it changes minds, I guess is what I'm trying to say. We've talked a lot at this program about believers of Donald Trump, some of whom I would say still continue to back him. This probably hasn't changed any of that. Those are not, however, the people that are leading the Department of
Justice. And we'll see how it plays out here in the Illinois primary. And we should mention that Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who's on the panel, has hinted at more revelations to come in future weeks. Let's move on to some other news. Jeremy Gorner, the Thompson Center, which is where the state of Illinois offices have been, at least their Chicago location, for many, many years. They sold it to a private developer. Now comes the news that Google might buy it. How likely is that to happen?
I mean, so far, I mean, it looks like that they're exploring the idea of doing it. I believe that the state had talked for years about selling this, and I guess a Chicago developer agreed to buy it, for $70 million. Of course, Google, entering the picture could be welcoming news, for the Thompson Center. Just the fact that they're in there, since we've seen other companies move out of Chicago, and obviously, it would be kind of interesting to see, they're kind of based in the West Loop now. It would be really interesting to see, what kind of influence they could have when they're in the heart of the government district, basically. But
the governor, I think, said recently that he don't want to do anything to interfere with the deal with this developer. We're still sort of waiting on word for that, and that he would try to accommodate and do anything that would help downtown. But no contract signed.
They're just in negotiations, basically.
Yep.
That deal is closed, correct?
The developer portion,
right. So Google would buy it from the developer, apparently.
We're unclear.
And maybe the developer is going to do a quick flip here on, like, flipping a brownstone, flipping the Thompson Center.
Just lease it, yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, well, at least it's going to still be around, and that would make Hellman Yacht happy. Let's talk about one more story here. Urban Prep Charter School. This was broken by WBEZ Dan Mihalopoulos. It's been lauded for its 100% graduation rate and college acceptance rate. And WBEZ finds that it's been in a lot of financial trouble. What's going on here?
Yeah, my colleague, the veteran education reporter, Sarah Karp, broke this story yesterday. And basically what you have here is CPS alleging a lot of different financial mismanagement on the part of Urban Prep, The head of Urban Prep was once Chicagoan of the Year, once lauded as a hero on the cover of People magazine in national media. And it's been a feel-good story among the charter school community, but what it's starting to really look like is more along the lines of the UNO schools, if you remember what happened there, or concept schools, which got into trouble with various federal authorities. In this case, it's CPS itself and CPS's inspector general who are looking at some of the ways that Urban Prep has tried to manage this situation, predatory loans, borrowing on credit cards, getting an advance from CPS. And at one point, special ed services were not being provided through Urban Prep to kids who needed that.
A lot that the inspector general is looking into. And I remember when Mayor Emanuel would really put Tim King, the former principal you're mentioning, on a pedestal and tout the success of that school. So more to come on that. But we are out of time. So our thanks to Craig Delamore, Amanda Vinicky, Jeremy Gorner, and Dan Mihalopoulos. And that is our show for this Friday night. And now for the Week in Review, I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a wonderful 4th of July weekend.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.